This is the podcast of AK from the Alaska Public Radio Network. AK is a weekly show that presents the stories and sounds of Alaska's characters, cultures, and current events. AK is made possible by a major grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by the Alaska Humanities Forum.
Ketchikan, Kotzebue, Dillingham, Sitka,
Chugiak, Fairbanks, Fort Yukon, Wrangell, Barrow, Unalaska, Dutch Harbor, Alaska-Narechamir.
From the frozen North Slope to soggy Southeast, from the Kuskokwim Delta to the Upper Yukon River, from the far reaches of the Aleutian Chain to the heart of the interior, this is AK. This week on AK, in 50 years of Alaska statehood, how have Alaska Natives fared? It all depends on who you ask.
The original Constitution was really good because it said, leave native lands to the native people for further decision by Congress. I thought that was good, you know. Obviously, ANCSA screwed that up, though.
The native role in statehood, the land claims movement, and the birth of the AFN. That and more coming up on AK from APRN. Welcome to AK. I'm Steve Heimel. As you might expect, there's been plenty of self-congratulation and backslapping in the commemoration of an event as momentous as Alaska becoming a state. But Alaska Natives have a different view. The First Alaskans Institute has been conducting its own discussions of statehood around the state, and Coordinator Liz Cheney, a Tlingit from CAIC, says many of the Natives who've been speaking feel disenfranchised.
You know when you go and stop by someone's house, and it's as if you're interrupting them? You knock on the door and they open it and they kind of give you this look and they're like, oh, hey, what's going on? And, oh, I'm just coming to say hi, see what's going on. Oh, yeah, come on in. And you go in and you get a feeling that you interrupted something that you shouldn't have. You have that coldness somehow come over you. So you make your polite goodbyes and you get out of there as soon as you can. I think that that's kind of the feeling that some Alaska Natives might have when they go to the Capitol building in Juneau, or when they try to connect with the state as a government. When you feel unwelcome, how often do you go back?
It's easier to see what she's talking about when you use the perspective of 50 years or even longer. It's not exactly that Alaska Natives have been denied direct political power under statehood. Alaska Federation of Natives co-chair Albert Kukesh is one of several Natives who have chaired legislative finance committees. And no political history of the Alaska legislature could be written without including the roles of Native lawmakers like John Sackett, Frank Ferguson, Frank Paratovich, Al Adams, Georgiana Lincoln. But throughout Alaska's entire 50 years of existence as a state, from a Native perspective, their subsistence rights and self-determination rights have been more or less continually under threat.
My sense is, and from listening to the people in my community and my elders, is that there was a disconnect, a disenfranchisement of the Alaska Native people in direct connection to statehood and how it came about. And I think that to some degree today, we still are not visible to the state of Alaska. Our tribes have not had any official recognition. The state has kind of gone back and forth depending on who the executive is. And we still have a relationship that is not quite functional.
It's a long and tangled history, but going back to the 1940s, two threads intertwine repeatedly. Efforts by white Alaskans to gain statehood and efforts by resource developers to extinguish the land rights of Alaska Natives. Alaska was born as a state when there was no Civil Rights Act. For 5 years, Congress had been actively wiping out Indian tribes nationwide, disregarding treaties and expecting Natives to assimilate into what they considered a dominant culture. This is now called the Termination Era. And it was at its height that statehood boosters like Territorial Governor Ernest Greening and Alaska Delegate Bob Bartlett started making headway in Congress, and Alaska statehood was seriously considered. Don Mitchell, an attorney and former vice president of the Alaska Federation of Natives, has extensively researched this history and documented it in two books, Take My Land, Take My Life, and Sold American. Mitchell says opponents of statehood argued that native land claims had to be settled before Alaska could become a state. But in the end, the Statehood Act left it vague.
Certainly what is in the Alaska Statehood Act in terms of a piece of statutory text is ambiguous with respect to preserving native land rights. I still to this day do not have a firm position as to whether or not that ambiguity was cupidity or stupidity. It is ironic that the guy who agreed about the mischievousness of unresolved native land claims as it affected statehood was Ernest Greening. And Ernest Greening's solution to all of that was to get rid of native land claims, be done with it. Zero goose egg. He was probably the leading proponent of that view privately. And he got language put into a number of the early statehood bills on the sly. But I'm satisfied that Bob Bartlett thought that it was unfair to screw the natives. If Bob Bartlett had been aggressive about it in the way that Ernest Greening was, it's an unknowable speculation, but my guess would be that the House bill could easily have had a section in it that would have been the equivalent of the section that Ernest Greening snuck into the Senate bill back in 1950, in which case there never would have been a Native Claims Settlement Act.
Well, it seems that every time that would happen, somebody would sound the alarm and these organizations would start lobbying the pertinent committee to get it fixed.
Oh, see, I don't think any of that's true.
Really?
Yeah. No,
well,
I think you're making it sound like there was an organized Native community in those days, and there was no such thing. There certainly was the Alaska Native Brotherhood, and it had a letterhead, and it had Bill Paul going for it. But I don't think there was anybody particularly at A and B other than Bill Paul that understood any of this stuff. If you look at the communication systems, there was no public radio, there was no internet, there was no newspapers. I mean, you know, that's why the Thunder Times, as you know, was started in the early 60s. To say that there are a bunch of people out there keeping an eye on this and that these people were operatives of Native institutions and that they had a play and an influence on all of this, I just don't think so.
Mitchell thinks Bob Bartlett was the strong influence, along with outsiders like attorney Jim Curry, who had represented Tlingit and Haida tribes. The two of them agreed that land claims should be left to another day. It wasn't long before that day came. Oil had been discovered at Prudhoe Bay, and to have a pipeline to Tidewater and Valdez required building an 800-mile pipeline across lands where land claims were still unresolved, some of them tracts traditionally used by Native peoples for hunting, fishing, and seasonal camps. Unlike logging, a huge project like that pipeline could not be financed without resolving Aboriginal land claims. The prospect of this settlement presented an enormous challenge for Alaska Natives, who were split along divergent regional, political, and economic interests. But as it turned out, there was a generation of savvy young Native leaders who had formed the ties to organize the political clout they needed. Coming from diverse backgrounds, they met at boarding schools. Ann Sutton reports.
Edward Ida was just 13 when he first left home. He was a young Inupiat from Barrow, bound for Wrangell Institute, a southeast boarding school run by the Bureau of Indian Affairs. It was 1959, the now mayor of the North Slope Borough recalls, and the first he'd heard of Alaska statehood.
This was my first time ever on an airplane, first time ever seeing trees and concrete and real cars. And there was this deal going on about, you know, the teachers down there and the matrons and whatnot were going on about, hey, Alaska's going to become a state. And I said, so? You know, I didn't have a clue about how that related to my personal life.
Another Inupiat, Willie Hensley, was 16 and heading home to Kotzebue from a boarding school in Tennessee. The future corporate head had to stop in Fairbanks along the way.
And so was engaged in the celebration of what I really didn't know. But there was. There was this huge star, you know, being held up by these balloons, you know, with the 49th state written on it.
Outside influences were at work that would forever change their way of life. But so far, Alaska Natives had been largely left out of the discussion. Still, Byron Malott, a Tlingit from Yakutat, said the full import was sinking in.
Statehood was a big thing. It caused you to think about the future. Even as a young person, you couldn't take who you were, where you were, what you were doing, where you were going for granted, because the earth was changing under your feet.
Malott was attending the Presbyterian-run Sheldon Jackson School in Sitka, which was also home to the BIA's Mount Edgecombe. Springtime in Sitka was like the Berlin airlift, he said.
Except with Grumman gooses, with, you know, just over a 2 or 3 day period when school was out, just airplane after airplane hauling students from Sheldon Jackson and Mount Edgecombe to Juneau, where they, of course, got on larger airplanes to head home.
For the first three quarters of the 20th century, most Native children from rural Alaska were sent away to boarding schools, either in the state or the lower 48. In many cases, the practice and some schools left tragic legacies of abuse and cultural breakdown. But the social benefits were also powerful, said Diane Hirschberg, an associate professor at the University of Alaska Institute for Social and Economic Research, who studied the impacts of boarding schools on Alaska Natives. She said students formed important social connections that they later came to rely on.
People didn't learn about Alaska Native history. They didn't learn about these concepts of colonialism or oppression of their peoples or of this history in the boarding school. That was something that they began to learn after they left. But again, then they could turn around and have a network instantly of people with whom they could organize.
While the educational goal was assimilation with the Western world, many students were exposed for the first time to other Native cultures. Malott joined the basketball team and formed lasting friendships with boys whose names now read like a roster of Alaska Native leaders: Oliver Levitt, Jake Adams, Maury Thompson, and others. Malott went on to college and returned home to become mayor of Yakutat at age 22. He left again to take a job as a local government specialist before being swept into the tidal stream that was the land claims movement. He eventually ended up the CEO of a regional Native corporation, one of the products of the movement. He wonders what Alaska Natives would have accomplished had it not been for those early friendships formed at school.
If we all stayed in our places and all of a sudden something like the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act issue was before us, would we have been able to come together and create the kind of unity and create an institution like the Alaska Federation of Natives? I don't think so, because history is replete with groups in similar circumstances all around the world who were never able to come together.
To this day, Malott says there's not a gathering of Native people in the state where he doesn't run into people from school. They may not always agree, but they still have much to share. For AK in Juneau, I'm Ann Sutton.
More on the buildup to the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act after the break. Welcome back to AK. Native relations with the new state of Alaska got off to a shaky start. A dozen years passed before Natives organized themselves and pushed for the federal land claim law that created today's powerful Native corporations. As AK's Alan Lockyer reports, not long after statehood, Native Alaskans got word of a proposed Bureau of Indian Affairs solution regarding their rights to ancestral lands and decided to head it off by taking matters into their own hands.
During the 1960s, Mike Gravel was one of Alaska's senators in Washington. Gravel had served in the state legislature, too, and had had a firsthand look at Native poverty.
It wasn't hard for me to support literally everything they wanted. It was a very, very difficult and sad situation how their needs were unattended to.
Emil Noddy remembers those days. He was born into a subsistence lifestyle.
You know, in the World War II, the villagers were pretty much fully employed. Every available man was working. After the war, the villagers were laid off with nothing.
These days, he settles back in his commissioner's chair in the 17th floor corner office overlooking the Alaska Range. It's a scene far removed from his growing up days in the Yukon River villages.
I split my time between Koyukuk and Ruby. I spent a couple years out in a trap line, and on the trap line, there were just my father and my brother. The years I would have been third and fourth grade.
He left Ruby at age 11 for boarding school at Aklutna and later Mount Edgecombe. Nothing at this point would prepare him for his role to come. But the Korean War started when he got out of high school, and he joined the Navy, where he found an aptitude for electronics and finished college.
I was gone about 10 years. I decided I wanted to come back to Alaska.
Naughty says he pretty much missed the 1959 statehood furor, but he came home in 1963 to a very different social landscape.
We were concerned about education, health conditions, housing, jobs, all the things that people get concerned about, and it shouldn't have been happening.
Alaska Natives had little left but the federal land they had freely used. Now the new state was starting to encroach on that.
And then statehood came, and states started selecting land, and they selected land, many of them around the villages. And that's what started causing conflict in land. State regulations and laws started restricting people's use of land. So the groups started filing protests. The protests were being filed with the Interior Department.
Their protests fell on deaf ears. Then in 1965, BIA Juneau Director Bob Bennett was selected to take a D.C. commissioner's chair and was asked by the Interior Department to draw up a report to solve the Indian problem in Alaska. Naughty got an advance copy of the 1966 report and took action to head off the BIA's solution.
I read that and I thought, well, if we have any rights in land, we should have something to say about it. So in July of 1966, I wrote a letter to, I think, about 14 people around the state. I asked them to come to a meeting in October to talk about land. And so in October, instead of 14 people showing up, 300 people showed up.
The result of the meeting was the formation of the Alaska Federation of Natives, with Naughty as its first president. They decided priority number one was to fight for land claims.
We had absolutely no money or organization. We had $9 in the bank. I quit a full-time job and took on the issue full-time. Things were pretty slim, but so it was a tough struggle to keep it going. But the interest was building, and people started following what we were doing.
In October of 1966, AFN developed a land position paper and submitted it to the Alaska Congressional Delegation. The bill went into committee and died. The inexperienced natives learned quickly then and got the bill put into an interior committee. Every state and federal agency involved wrote similar bills. In the end, 8 land claims settlement bills were introduced, which were all eventually boiled down to one, the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act. Even before ANCSA, some natives, like the Tlingits and Haidas, had successfully claimed land through a federal court system, a system Naughty says only cheated them.
It wasn't a fair settlement, and for all of the Tongass forest, they got $7 million.
And worse than that, Mike Revelle says, BIA rules allowed the federal government to control any money the tribes made on the land.
And so when the Native Claims issue came up, I was the first to back their demands for land. Sure, they got their 40 million acres. Sure, they got $1 billion. And it's brought about great success for the Native community of Alaska. But the most important part of that is that the Native community got full control of their assets.
The new state of Alaska opposed ANCSA, claiming that Native people had no rights to the land. It took 4 years, but the ANCSA we have today passed in 1971. Naughty led the Native delegation and headed testimony in Washington for all that time.
We didn't get all we wanted, but it was amazing that we got a bill at all because we had no money. We had volunteer lawyers, and I was paid $1,000 a month to do the work, which was barely enough to live on.
But conflicts with the state over subsistence and tribal sovereignty seem to be ongoing. Some younger natives say ANCSA needs a new look. Matt Gilbert is a graduate student at UAF.
I'm not saying to change much, just give tribes a lot more power over the corporations, because it's the tribes has traditionally worked best for governing Native people.
Gilbert may be looking toward the future of young Alaska Natives, but Nadi says 37 years ago, he and others were looking ahead as well. Nadi says ANCSA was in many ways a social experiment that took people like himself from the trap line into a Western economy. He says the wealth of the state lies in the bush, and new energy-related projects may bring new development and new challenges to rural villages. For AK, I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Where people like Emil Nadi and Matt Gilbert don't always see eye to eye comes down to this. Tribes and tribal nonprofits and regional for-profit corporations often disagree over how best to use land set aside under ANCSA. The Interior's regional native corporation, Doyon, faced huge opposition from villages in the region when they wanted to trade Doyon land for other land within the Yukon Flats National Wildlife Refuge in order to pursue oil and gas development. Dacho Alexander is chief of the Gwich'in Tribal Government in Fort Yukon. He believes the lands should be used for subsistence and other traditional uses.
What we have today in the Yukon Flats is we actually have the villages fighting against our regional corporation. Our same regional corporation, which was entrusted with our land for protection, they were entrusted with all of this land, all of our traditional hunting areas, all of our traditional use areas. And for protection, at least that's the way we saw it.
But the corporations have an obligation to use that land to make money. David Getches, dean of the University of Colorado Law School, was a Native American Rights Fund attorney in the 1970s. He was the attorney who helped incorporate the North Slope Borough, and he says there is an inherent conflict.
Is it the corporation's fault themselves? I think they're just pursuing what is their obligation under corporate law. If you have to pin the blame someplace, pin it on the Congress of the United States for its lack of wisdom in passing the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act in the first place.
But the corporations have grown to be some of the most successful in the state, and they're required to share their profits. It's not likely that tribal governments who oppose ANCSA will be able to get back what they feel they lost. But those same governments are becoming more vocal and more involved, and will likely have an even greater influence on decisions in the regional corporations in the future. The Native regional corporations are generally wealthier than the corporations set up to govern village lands, but lately the village corporations have been finding their way toward building local economies. Take the village of Port Graham at the bottom of the Kenai Peninsula, for instance. A village that had been based on subsistence was suddenly in control of more than 110,000 acres of ancestral land. They weren't sure what to do with it at first, but over the last 30 years they've been figuring it out. Their latest venture is signing a long-term lease agreement with the ecotourism business Alaska Wildland Adventures for land located west of Seward in Iyalik Bay. Ann Kaiser has more.
Stories of the origin of Port Graham Village are still being told by the elders there. They tell of the Sukpiak people coming from deep within Prince William Sound, down the eastern side of the Kenai Peninsula, to current-day Port Graham. Jim LaBelle Sr. says these stories helped shape the land selection process when the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act was passed. Of the 110,000 acres of ancestral land that came back to them, 40,000 acres is outside their township.
There was only so much land available to select because we were next to two other villages, Saldovia and Nunwaluk. So it squeezed some of our land selection further up into the Kenai Peninsula on the Pacific Rim site, and it put us right into the Kenai Fjords, Harding Ice Field, in places like Peterson Lagoon and Iyalik Bay.
LaBelle Sr. says early on these lands were identified as possible locations for small-scale ecotourism or nature tour areas. They just didn't know when it would happen. Now construction's underway, and lodge operations are scheduled to begin next spring.
So, of course, you can see the lodge being built right here, and the lodge is going to be about right around 3,000 square feet, and then most little cabins will be 12 foot by 24.
Kirk Hassel, owner of Alaska Wildland Adventures, has been in business over 30 years. He says the lodge is set away from the outer coast with views of a lagoon, and its surrounding buildings are spread over less than 10 acres. At full capacity, they'll house 30 to 35 visitors. Their goal is to share Alaska's remote wilderness one small group at a time while preserving its resources.
Because they were willing to set aside the rest of their land holdings in this immediate area, something like 1,700 acres, that'll be involved in a sanctuary called the Pedersen Lagoon Wildlife Sanctuary. And so every visitor that comes to the lodge will also get to explore the sanctuary around the lodge.
That provision was one of many, and the lease agreement worked out over a two-year period. Port Graham board member James LaBelle Jr. says, in addition, they wanted to make sure these visitors knew about their village, the history of their land, and the culture that went along with it.
There's opportunities for cultural sharing in terms of either the selling of Native art from our area or having some of our people go out and do some of our Native dances. There is another clause in our agreement that says that, you know, they'll hire shareholders when possible.
LaBelle Jr. says early on, they weren't quite ready for the complexity of working relationships and the Western business models that came along with ANCSA, so it's taken time for Port Graham to get on its feet. But finally, they're at a point they've always wanted to be financially.
Last year, we finally came out of the red and we're now profitable again. But now we have to really take more of a proactive approach to our self-sufficiency. And we have to fully learn, you know, these systems and these ways of doing business and make sure that it's an upward trend and it can sustain that growth.
Previous business ventures didn't always work out. Port Graham CEO Lloyd Stiasny says this time they wanted to limit their risks and seize new opportunities to partner with companies that have a successful track record and share common values.
So that you can gain and glean the expertise and grow with somebody that cares about you and not always in a way that perhaps even generates the most money or income, because that over time many times isn't what is the critically important thing. It's more about developing relationships and expertise and empowering these groups and communities for, you know, future generations.
There'll be some hiking. Our agreement allows us to build a trail from here to the outer coast along the cliffside here and perhaps up to the ridge.
Time will tell if this special place will resonate with visitors as the ancestors envisioned when they named it. Ayalik means light and desire. Reporting in Ayalik Bay, I'm Ann Kaiser.
There was no Federal Civil Rights Act 50 years ago, and in that era, you can find discrimination against Alaska Natives just about wherever you look, including Bristol Bay.
When I was born, it was just the advent of motorized vessels. My dad fished a couple of years in a sailboat.
Alaska Native Robin Samuelson followed his father, Harvey Samuelson, into the fishery. He says Yupik Eskimos got the shaft in the early days of the state's largest salmon fishery.
There was different limits for locals. Prior to that, there was hand-me-down gear. They couldn't order new gear. It was a kind of a discriminatory fishery against the locals. It favored more the outsiders. The canneries controlled everything back then. And the new boats went to the outsiders, not to the locals. The gear was hand-me-down gear. What the outsiders didn't want, they always got the new gear. There was different limits when you went to deliver. That's just the way it was. And my dad, along with people over in Aknik and here, decided to break that mold and break that stranglehold by the canneries and get some independence. So they formed fishermen associations. you know, that was all going on when I was a kid, and I never paid too much attention to it, but eventually they were able to buy their own nets. They got equal limits. They were treated equally. And right up until the 91 strike, you know, 1991, we had WACMA. We had three fishing organizations in Bristol Bay. Just prior to that, everybody negotiated their prices. My dad said a lot of times in the early years when they struck, and he'd talk with people like Joe Clark from Clark's Point and people from Togiak and Naknek and around the bay, that they didn't strike for a price, which the processors were thinking of. They were striking so they could get more escapement up to the river system because the Japanese had decimated our run so bad. And they were trying to speed up the recovery of our salmon runs here in Bristol Bay. A lot of disasters declared back then. Economic disasters because no fish returned into our streams. But they were effective, you know. I mean, we've got a pretty much an independent fleet. Everybody's treated equally. And the old hierarchy of the cannery days are pretty much gone.
Robin Samuelson now heads the Bristol Bay Economic Development Corporation, a community development quota group. That quota has provided the income to buy half of one of the larger seafood processors operating there, Ocean Beauty Seafoods. The community development quotas have provided sustenance to a number of coastal communities by giving them a control of a portion of federal fisheries. They were put in place through the work of Senator Ted Stevens. It's just one example of the many ways that Stevens has helped Alaska's rural communities. But don't get the idea that all Alaska Natives are fans of Ted Stevens.
Yeah, I'm glad he was found guilty. I wish they'd take the rest of them down.
More on our convicted senator's history with Natives after the break. You're listening to AK from the Alaska Public Radio Network. I'm Steve Heimel. This week we're marking the 50th anniversary of Alaska statehood and what it meant for Alaska Natives. And it's hard to talk about Alaska and statehood without mentioning Ted Stevens. Here's an example.
My name is Harold Donnelly. I'm from Sitka, Alaska. I grew up in Sitka, and then I went to the University of Alaska. And while I was at University of Alaska, you know, they passed the legislation to become a state. At first, I didn't like it because we were kind of afraid that we'd lose our funding, you know. But then as years went by, it was a lot better, you know. And we've got better representation in Congress than, you know, like Senator Stevens, you know, he's the longest senator that's ever served. And he's a real good advocate for Alaska Natives, you know. So, you know, I think overall, I think that statehood did us good.
Ted Stevens was there in Washington, D.C. when statehood passed the Senate as a young Interior Department staffer. He's been our senator for 40 years. He's often called Uncle Ted, and he's generally regarded as the most important public figure in Alaska's life as a state. But Ted Stevens is in trouble. He's been convicted by a jury on 7 felony counts for concealing lavish gifts. The conviction came just a few days after the Alaska Federation of Natives gave him a standing ovation at their convention. And he wasn't even there. He appeared by video, asking for their prayers. But as Johanna Urich reports, the relationship between Alaska Natives and Senator Stevens, though warm, has also been troubled.
It's no secret that Alaska's Uncle Ted has a special fondness for rural natives. For more than 4 decades, he's demonstrated that tenderness in myriad ways. Every trip home finds him traveling to the bush, bringing much-needed funds for everything from roads, housing, clinics, water systems, airports, to schools and harbors. Willie Kasalyuli lives in the Yupik village of Akiachuk.
He was more friendly towards natives in terms of advocating for economic development. Although we had some disagreements on the tribal issues, he was always welcoming us and listened to us.
But it hasn't always been that way.
In the late 60s and early 70s, when Stevens was just beginning his long career in the U.S. Senate, natives felt the brunt of his temper when they pushed for a bigger land settlement than Stevens' initial offer of $10 million and 10 million acres. Gary Patton, head of the Council of Elders for the Koyuk Tlingits, reads from the affidavit of Edward Naughton. Naughton represented Kodiak Island on the Alaska Federation of Natives Board when the group was lobbying for land claims.
Later, when we met with Senator Stevens, he was livid. How dare we turn down his offer? I distinctly remember him snarling, "I'll get you for this, you son of a bitches." That tended to indicate that our senator was not on our side.
Patton, a tribal advocate, is still bitter. He says the federal funds Stevens has brought home does not nearly compensate natives for what they gave up. He's not sad to see the senator convicted on corruption charges.
Yeah, I'm glad he was found guilty. I wish they'd take the rest of them down. You know, the corruption has gone on so long, and Alaska's probably got the most corrupt bunch in the whole union.
Stevens has never been supportive of tribes. He was part of the generation which saw nothing but institutionalized poverty and despair on the Indian reservations in the lower 48. He supported using the corporate model to help Alaska natives build a brighter future. But in the 80s, just 10 years after passage of the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act, natives, disenchanted with the inability of their corporations to improve village life, headed outside to reservations to study how tribes work. Some came back to Alaska and used the Federal Indian Reorganization Act to grow their tribal and village councils. Alaska Senator Ted Stevens actively opposed those tribes. History professor Steve Haycock says the senator had no choice but to fight tribal rights.
Well, I think he has to, as a representative of the state of Alaska. The state of Alaska is always going to be jealous of its own sovereignty. As a representative of Alaska, he has always opposed native sovereignty, and I think that any major Alaska representative would do likewise.
The arguments over whether there are tribes in Alaska was put to rest in the Clinton administration when Assistant Secretary of Interior Ada Deer officially recognized over 200 tribes here. Quickly following that, Stevens rushed language through Congress recognizing a number of Native corporations as tribes. The stage was set for the legal battle over whether Alaska's tribes had jurisdiction over land or were in effect reservations. The courts have ruled that Alaska's tribes don't control land, but that does not stop tribes from exercising authority over their members. Today, there are tribal courts and tribal police officers in many villages. Over the last two decades, Uncle Ted has gained an appreciation of Alaska's tribes as a mechanism to deliver money to rural Alaska. One of the senator's proudest accomplishments, the Denali Commission, has spent over $1 billion in rural villages during the last 10 years. Some of that money has gone directly to tribes, recognizing the role that they now play. It's not unusual for tribes to help small local governments by pooling federal tribal funds with cities to build roads, landfills, or other facilities. Faced with either a weakened or absent Stevens in the Senate, many Native leaders worry the flow of funds to rural Alaska will dry up. His opponent, Democrat Mark Begich, has suggested that the Denali Commission could continue to move federal money to villages if its mission was broadened to include rural communities in the U.S. But Ken Johns, president and CEO of the Otna Corporation, says it will take a long time to replace the political muscle of Senator Ted Stevens.
You know, I've been traveling to Washington, D.C. to talk with our congressional people for over 20-some years now. And if I learned some, I learned that seniority and holding committee assignments under is everything in regards to getting major legislation passed and gaining funding for needed projects here in Alaska.
It remains to be seen whether the affection of Alaska Natives for their Uncle Ted will translate into votes. When they gave the senator a standing ovation, he had not yet been convicted of 7 felony counts for failing to properly report gifts he'd received from an oil support industry executive. Stevens needs the Native vote if he's to survive the toughest election fight of his career. I'm Johanna Urich.
The flight from Kotzebue to Point Hope takes you over a coastline which in the 1960s was frozen most of the year. But when the ice on the Arctic Ocean opened up in the spring, Inupiat hearts lifted as the table was set for the most coveted meal of the year. Vic Fisher, a longtime Alaska resident, treasures this memory of going out on the ice for the spring whale hunt in the company of Howard Rock, Alaska's foremost native journalist.
I was flying to Point Hope from Kotzebue back in 1969. I was sitting next to Howard Rock, who was publisher, editor of the Tundra Times, and he was looking out the window, and he said, "Vic, this is what I live for." And there, this was in April, and there was a lead. The ice had receded from the land, a lead of about 100, 200 feet. And it was along the shore for mile after mile after mile, and it looked like there was a highway. From our height, it looked like there were white cars moving north and an occasional big, dark truck moving in the same direction at about the same speed. And they were belugas and whales moving up. And Howard was just almost emotional. He said, "I'm sure my Point Hope people will be out on the ice." And sure enough, as we approached Point Hope, the village, and the plane was coming down, there was the whole village several miles, about maybe a mile or two, out on the ice. And there were white wall tents set up. As we were landing, a number of snow machines came up, and we went directly out on the ice. I was watching Howard. He was in his element. It was his Alaska. It was his people. And then they got three whales that day. And, of course, it was a phenomenal sight just seeing the boats lined up along the ice, and when a whale would come along, they'd go out. Over a number of hours, everybody participated in pulling the whales onto the ice and cutting big chunks out. The women were making donuts and cooking the muktuk, which would just melt in your mouth, and feeding the people. And it was a scene that was just hard to imagine if you weren't there. And I sort of related to Howard because this was his, you know, it was his heritage, it was his. And one fascinating aspect of being there was to see they had poles, three of the tents. You had the American flag waving. Those were the tents of the captains whose team had gotten a whale. I have thought of that as I've heard a native saying, I don't consider myself an Alaskan, I don't consider myself an American, I consider myself a native.
Vic Fisher was a member of Alaska's Constitutional Convention. Jack Schaefer from the whaling town of Point Hope may consider himself an American, but an Alaskan? He's not so sure. He spoke with AK's Ellen Lockyer at this year's AFN convention about statehood.
You know, you had to have some way to keep your government running, and so they made those adjustments, and I feel that the North Slope should become their own state because of the hostility the state has towards subsistence.
Wilson Justin of the Copper Basin might not go quite so far as advocating secession, but he does think statehood and the land claims were rushed a bit too fast for natives.
I was 9 years old when it happened. So as far as I'm concerned, I should have waited till I was 19, and I think, because, well, you look at it this way, the voting was flawed to begin with. It was one way. There was no education, and the people who were, the native people, never really were asked or given much of a chance to really vote their convictions. You know, it was a topic of discussion in the village for a year. I think they were basically asked to trust and have faith, and it's okay in some instances, but as it turned out, we could have done better if we waited a little longer. You know, I was lucky. Statehood didn't impact my family or my quality of life that much, but it really damaged the elders and the older folks. And I think the young natives, the ones who are in the process of coming into the world now, will suffer grievously in about 15 to 20 years. We're going to have a very polarized state. It was a miracle that Native Alaskan, especially the elders, did as good as they did from 1959 to 2009. Can't help but think that if they would have waited 15 years or so, just like with Engska, those of us who were high school educated and capable of walking both worlds could have gotten us a much better deal.
As for Liz Cheney at the First Alaskans Institute, she's glad they've been providing a forum for Alaska Natives to talk about their relationship with the state. It's a conversation she hopes is the first step to making things better.
And I'll tell you, one of the things that an audience member shared with me after we concluded, in kind of talking about the conversation and the things that we had discussed, she said she wasn't sure if she even wanted to come, because she wasn't sure what it was about. And if it was about celebrating statehood, she wasn't sure if she wanted to do that or if she was ready to do that, which I really appreciated, because that's why we're having this discussion. You know, there are many people who are celebrating Alaska's 50th anniversary as a state of the United States, but there are so many other people who have never had a voice in that conversation and have never had the opportunity to say, wait a second, you know, maybe that wasn't the best thing. Maybe the way that it was handled maybe it wasn't done right, you know, and to be more of critical at a time when people want to celebrate, maybe it kind of looks a little like crying over spilled milk, and nobody wants to be that guy. But as a young Alaskan, you know, if I'm an Alaskan, I think it's really important that we have these conversations, that we start talking about things that may or may not have been done correctly in the past, so that we have a chance of trying new things for the future instead of just carrying on the same old from a long time ago. I wouldn't want us to be burdened with bad habits from 50 years ago. I'd rather take the time now to start talking about and figure out a way for us to mend this relationship.
Maybe that's a goal for the next 50 years. We'll be looking ahead to Alaska's future on our next Statehood Anniversary Special. That's coming up in a month. This week we had help from Ann Sutton in Juneau and Johanna Urich in Anchorage. Our theme music is by Bamua. For more on the other music we use, head to our website, akradio.org. While you're there, sign up for our podcast, check out our archives, and send us an email to let us know how we're doing. Our address is ak@aprn.org. AK's Ellen Lockyer reported from Anchorage this week, and Bonnie Sue Hitchcock. Gooseberry Peter is our audio engineer. Our producer is Jessica Cochran, and our editor and executive producer is Duncan Moon. I'm Steve Heimel. Join us again next week.